This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my amazing and curious friends. My name is Jennifer, the Dean of all things STEM and STEAM. And this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek inside the real world of scientists, engineers, and experts as they solve problems in their jobs using creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. And now please welcome to the show my podcast partner, Galactic Space Geek, Jeff Gagne.
Hello, Jennifer, and hello, listeners. We have one of those episodes that gets me fired up to get it started and share it with all of you, because not everybody likes every part of science, kind of like Jen and I do. But today's episode is going to touch everybody because we all either have or live right near a backyard.
So what is the problem we're solving today?
How do you create a backyard habitat?
How do you create a backyard habitat? Oh, there are probably going to be some amazing tips from this episode. Who is our guest today, Jeff?
Our guest today is the fantastic author of dozens of books, Sneed Collard III.
Welcome to the show, Sneed.
Thank you. It's been a long time since we've seen each other, and I'm really glad to meet up, even online here.
I am too. I'm thrilled that you're on the show, and I'm so excited because you are so knowledgeable about so many things, just like Jeff was saying. You know, it's like I don't even know where to start, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, how did you become a marine biologist? Because I didn't know that about you. Did you always want to be a marine biologist?
Well, I was kind of blindsided by my parents. Three of my four parents were biologists when I was
born.
And my mom was a lifelong high school science teacher with a big passion in marine mammals. My dad studied plankton and Newston and sea turtles and all kinds of things.
Oh, wow.
And my stepfather studied marine bioluminescence. And so when I went to college, I didn't hesitate to study to declare a marine biology major. And full disclosure, I only worked in that field for a little while afterward because I was eager to become an author. But I took all of that scientific background and poured it into the things that I write.
Oh, that's so cool.
So that leads me right to asking, if you were that eager to become an author, was your first book around the topic of marine biology?
It was. It was called Sea Snakes, and it was about these venomous snakes that live in the world's oceans. And actually, my dad gave me the idea for that. An editor called me up and said, Sneed, how would you like to write a reptile book for us? And I said, sure, but I didn't know what. So I called my dad and he's going, what about sea snakes? And I thought, God, that's perfect because no one had ever written about them before.
No.
That's terrific.
Yeah, that's the key, right? Like if no one ever has that topic, then, you know, then you open the door. Okay, so I guess, how did you get from marine biology? Because we're talking about backyard habitats. Did your experience with your books take you to becoming, you know, interested in your backyard? Or how did you get there?
Well, you know, the first time I got interested in backyard habitat is when a brush fire burned down my mom's neighborhood in California.
Oh, my gosh.
Her house was one of the few that survived. But in the back hill, there had been all this chaparral and now it was gone. And I thought, oh, this is a great opportunity to plant oak trees. And so I went to the local nursery, bought a bunch of oak trees, put them in, and they grew okay. But then the next year I planted acorns. And within 5 years, the ones from acorns had outpassed the ones I got from the nursery.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Yes. And so that was my first experiment with backyard habitat. And then I think it got revitalized again. I moved to Montana after that.
Right.
And I wrote a book called The Prairie Builders, where they took this old nuclear power plant site and they recreated native tall grass prairie from it. And I was so inspired by that that I came home and I started creating prairie habitat around my house here in Missoula, Montana. And then we moved houses and I did the same thing all over again at my new house, but with some significant new challenges, especially deer.
Oh.
Okay. So with that story, I appreciate you taking us all the way to Montana and I want to get back there, but I want to go all the way back to when you first started this in your mom's backyard.
Yeah.
You first picked oak trees
right.
to plant, but then those didn't do as well. Before you went and picked acorn, did you do research to figure out what to do? Or did you go talk to the local nursery on why the oaks weren't? How did you pick acorn next?
I was flying by the seat of my pants here, you know.
The best kind of science.
But I had read, I knew that oak trees had big, complex root systems. And I thought, okay. You know, if they got started in a pot, those root systems may have been a little verklempt, as they might say.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And so I thought, okay, if I plant the acorns, they might do a lot better. One thing, I think my first crop of acorns got all eaten, actually. Uh-oh. And then I realized I had to protect them from predators, too. And so I actually constructed cages all the way around them and down into the ground. So gophers couldn't get them from below and rabbits couldn't get them from above. And that
that's a commitment. So,
yeah. And I planted 3 acorns in each one, figuring one would survive. They all 3 survived, though, in each of the plots. So I actually had I just picked the most vigorous one and I snipped the other 2 off. And today those trees, it's been about 30 years and those trees are at least 25, 30 feet high.
Wow.
And they are amazing habitat. And the reason, by the way, I picked oak trees is I love oak trees, first of all, but they're right. also the keystone species out there. You know, they're
okay.
the one that all the other animals and plants depend on. And so, especially the animals.
So did that help the area behind your mom's house kind of come back after this big brush fire that took out everything?
No, the remarkable thing about the brush fire is the chaparral needs to burn. It is designed to burn.
Oh,
and okay. in fact, it was so fun watching it come back because suddenly what had been choked by brush now had this incredible diversity of plants growing back and a diversity of animals that I'd never seen before. Within the first 2 years in our yard, we saw foxes, coyotes, roadrunners. I'd never seen roadrunners in the backyard.
Whoa.
I have never seen that other than on TV and cartoons.
Maybe.
But yeah. we had to go there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm hoping I haven't been back to the oak trees for quite a while, but I'm hoping now acorn woodpeckers are feeding on them and it's providing shelter for just all kinds of different things.
That's terrific.
That is cool.
We always think when we hear the phrase circle of life, mm-hmm. and everybody knows that phrase. We always think of animal life. You know, smaller animals are getting right. eaten by larger animals, and the humans are happy to be at the top of the food chain as long as we don't fall into the wrong part of the petting zoo kind of thing. But the fact that fire and burns like that wildfire are part of the circle of life for plants is really neat to hear.
Oh, yeah. And it's true over so much of the country. Here in Montana, it's the same thing. To really maintain diversity, you need to have these fires. And they have to be different temperatures, too. I mean, the hot fires are good for some plants and animals. The medium fires are good for others.
Wow.
So ideally, you get this big fire that's a patchwork of different things. And I actually wrote another book called Firebirds, showing how these woodpeckers need these burned forests. And so this is a theme that's run through a lot of my work.
Yeah, I thought I remember hearing about that book, and I was surprised to hear that these birds thrive in stuff like this. So I want to talk a little bit about backyard habitats and like the one you created in Montana. So,
yeah.
So did you do research to find out like what indigenous plants you should plant? Or did you just be like, hey, I like this plant and this is what I'm going to put in my backyard?
A little of both, actually.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So we were fortunate enough to be able to buy a brand new house. But what that meant was that the surrounding area around the house had been scraped bare pretty much.
Yep. Sure. We've had one of those. It's tough. It's sad too, kind of, right?
Because you know you're responsible for removing habitat, you know?
Yeah.
And so my goal was to make this better than it was before, right? You know?
Okay.
So,
good goal to have.
Yeah. And so I was lucky. There was a woman who was running her own native plant nursery here.
Oh, nice.
And I had some ideas about what I wanted to plant, but I also went and asked her. And I just went for everything. I bet I put in 30 or 40 different species in around the house.
Wow.
And the deer loved it. It was like a smorgasbord.
Look, there's a garden he planted for us right here.
This guy's great.
Yeah, and they were so fickle. They would come and they'd just yank a plant out of the ground and not even eat it sometimes, right?
Oh my gosh. Now they're just messing with you. Yeah.
They were messing with me. But what happened was that some of the plants survived. In fact, there was really kind of an adaptation going on that was fascinating because when we first moved in, the deer wouldn't eat certain species of plants. And over the next 5-10 years, they learned to eat a lot of them that they weren't eating before.
Huh.
And so that was also very interesting. But what I realized with the deer is that I had to have two approaches. I had to find plants that were just bulletproof. Or I had to protect them, right?
Right.
Sure. And
so I was lucky out in front. I planted quite a few shrubs that the deer didn't like maple sumac, buffalo berry, which has these great big thorns that deter.
Oh, yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. More oak trees. I did some research to see, did any native oaks live in Montana?
I have to say, I love oak trees too. We've planted those at our first house. And that was 25 years ago, and they're really, really, really tall. And yeah,
Florida has such beautiful oak trees.
They do.
They're just amazing. But I found the only one in Montana was this scrubby, kind of pathetic little oak that lived in one corner of the state, the southeast corner. But I thought, no matter, I'm going to plant them anyway. And they turned out to be a great choice because they don't grow too big and cause problems out on the street and the sidewalk and everything. But then in the protected areas, I put a lot of traditional prairie plants like coneflower, echinacea, bee balm, goldenrod.
Okay.
Some other coneflowers that aren't as well known. And so, and one of my favorite that the deer didn't learn to eat till later was golden currant. And so I was just experimenting a lot. And I got lucky with a lot of the things. I'd say I probably lost 3/4 of my plants to deer.
Oh, wow.
I was going to say, because they died. That would be me. I don't have a green thumb or patience with plants.
No, they would have survived except for the deer. And incidentally, I now let my dog chase the deer out of the yard. She knows to stop right at the edge of the yard. But I think that's fair game. This is her yard, right?
And sure.
She should get to chase them when she feels like it.
Yes.
Anyway, so yeah, and my favorite plants turned out to be the ones that, what I discovered is that for birds, two qualities were really important. One was the shelter aspect, right? So you need good brushier plants, right?
Right.
People think everything has to be so manicured. Well, messier is better. The messier you can make it, the better for birds, right? So if you put in brushes, don't over manicure them, right? And the other thing is, what kind of berries did they produce, you know? And so the golden currant berries get taken out right away by cedar waxwings and robins and stuff. The buffalo berries, they're like a food bank for birds, right?
Oh.
So they go and they eat everything else. And then you get into the heart of winter, when food is scarcer, and suddenly one day you look out there and there are flickers and waxwings and robins and all kinds of stuff in the buffalo berries, cleaning them out, you know.
Okay. Wow. Ooh. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're kind of starting into the question I want to ask next is, why is creating backyard habitat important?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that is a great question. And there's probably several reasons for it. But one is that when we build our buildings, especially houses and subdevelopments, we are destroying vast amounts of habitat for wildlife. And while there's certain animals you don't want to encourage in your neighborhood, like mountain lions and AP raccoons and stuff like that.
Sure.
Deer in my case, but anyway, that's another story. especially for birds and things, if you can replace that habitat, that can be a vital resource for birds because they are habitat destruction, as you both know, is probably right up there with climate change as far as being the number one threat to birds, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, that. And also they have problems with lights, right? Light pollution. Doesn't that affect birds too?
Oh, yeah, definitely that does too. There are some good lights out programs in big cities to tackle that, but not in small towns like Missoula or where you guys live either, probably.
Yeah.
But that's a huge reason to restore habitat. And another reason I wanted to do it was to show people that there's more to life than boring manicured lawns.
Oh, thank you. Could you? Yeah, yes. That's what we have here in Florida. We're in a homeowners association and you have to. And, you know, I grew up in Central Illinois, so we had messy backyards. We had a creek in our backyard on the other side of the fence. And, you know, we used to rake leaves and dump them in the creek. We would dump all, like, we would cut trees and we would dump it into the creek to prevent the erosion, right?
Oh, right.
And that was all normal. And then when I kind of started doing the same thing here, because we have like a little kind of little bit of a forest protected area right behind us, my neighbors are like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm recycling." Like, yeah. Isn't it better to put it in there than bag it and leave it on the curb for the truck to take? I mean, yeah, I don't like living in manicured places. But what I want to ask too is, like, how do you do this? Because I've always wondered, where do you start? Imagine someone like me who knows nothing about the native plants other than, you know, it's Florida palm trees. But if I wanted to do something cool in my backyard, assuming my dog wouldn't dig it up, where would I start?
Well, and this goes to our challenge question at the end too, right? So I would start by going to your local nursery and asking them, okay, what native plants do you have here that are good for birds and or butterflies, right?
Right.
And just pick out one or two, you know? You don't need to decide to do your whole lawn all at one
time. Right.
Think about, and then ask them also, okay, do I need to protect this at all? And they should know, right?
Yeah.
And especially for shrubs, if there are a lot of deer around, you're probably going to need to protect them, okay? And so then I would just find a nice spot to put that one shrub or plant, or if it's a tree, you can put that in. But also, one thing that most people don't do, even if they mean well with their gardens, is you have to think 20, 30, 50 years ahead.
Oh,
right.
A tree that's 4 feet tall, you have to imagine, what is that tree going to look like 50 years from now? Is a branch going to be hanging over my roof so the next hurricane, I'm going to have to cut this tree down, right?
Yes.
Will it provide shade for my house and help save energy?
Right.
Is it going to encroach on other things I've got going on, like the pool or, you know, the fence or whatever?
Sure. So,
and most people who plant trees, I'd say 99% of the people I see who plant trees never think more than about a year ahead. And so
That's probably true.
And so when you become a habitat restorer, you have to be a visionary too. You have to imagine what it's going to look like. And while you're at it, a lot of trees, for instance, suffer from disease and things like that. You got to make sure you don't plant a tree that is, you know, vulnerable to a weevil or a beetle or something like that, where
right.
And so I just start with one of those, and even one plant that produces berries can bring so much joy to your life. Is it butterflies and birds? It's really, it's magic.
Berries are the best.
Yep.
So I love the long-term strategy that goes into this. And I really think, even just like you said, getting started can really help shift people's thinking about the places that we live. Mm-hmm. So I live in Colorado. My parents have retired to just outside of Phoenix, Arizona, two very dry places. Yeah. And the idea of the world is running out of water is coming back with a vengeance right now. Right. Can you talk a little bit about how native backyard habitat is one of the ways that we can combat how much water we use for our life outside?
That's such a good point. And what I didn't mention, but was thinking about, native plants tend to use just whatever water is available naturally. Mm. Okay. And so while we have to water our lawns like crazy, the more lawn you can replace with native plants, the less irrigation you're going to have to do
on your place. Right.
And so even though I do water my native plants with drip systems, most of them would do fine without it. And I keep thinking about, you know, tearing up my whole lawn, but then the homeowners association would probably have a fit where we live, you know. But if you can even reduce your lawn a little bit, the amount of lawn space you have, and put in native shrubs, you're just helping in so many ways. More animal habitat, helping, you know, sustain native plants, reducing water, more carbon storage for that helps the climate change problem, you know. And so there, it's really a win-win-win-win-win situation.
I like that.
Yeah. Well, now I want to switch a little bit and talk about your birding experience, because that's how I met you. I believe we were on the same panel. You were talking about one of your birding books. Okay. So ever since I met you, I have been noticing birds more. In fact, listeners, I showed or told Sneed a beautiful hawk was on the top of our house a couple of weeks ago. And I was like, look, and that made me think of that. But so if I want to bring birds to the back of my house, is it better to put in plants or should I actually put in like a bird feeder?
Well, you can do both, actually. Cool. And I do both. The plants are going to draw certain birds, but they won't necessarily hang out all the time in your particular yard.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
If you want to see birds every day, then the feeder is a really good idea. Stick to a really basic feed like black oil sunflower seeds. You know, don't get these fancy mixes that have all kinds of...
I would be sucked into those. Yes, look, buy this.
Yeah, they make really pretty packaging.
Yes,
and then,
they do. That would be me.
But there's also, you know, the more you learn about birds too, the more you have to be aware of what you're attracting. Like if there are starlings and house sparrows coming to your feeder and that's all that comes, you don't want to be feeding those birds because they're invasive species. They bully other birds. They nest in your house. And
No. I'm out right there.
But if you put up a feeder, you will start to learn which birds are around your house, you know, and that's the cool thing about the feeder is it gives you a lot of repetition for identification, right?
Well, and now I'm going to have to do this. Yeah.
Yeah. And then also you might want to put up a bird house, but again, you have to be very careful. I want to attract chickadees and red-breasted nuthatches to my bird houses, and hole size has to be 1.25 inches. If it's 1.5, house sparrows are going to nest in there. Okay. That's a quarter difference, right?
Right.
And so they are very particular, and you have to really do your research for... Don't just go buy a pretty birdhouse at your garden supply house. You're going to get birds you don't want, almost guaranteed.
And here I was just thinking, my daughter's 11. I was thinking one of those little kits that costs, you know, $6.99, and she builds it and paints it all these pretty colors. But now That's out of the question.
Either. Yeah, but the kits could be great, you know, but you just have to look at the hole diameter.
Right.
And see what they're aiming for with that particular design.
Okay, so since we're talking about the birding, and I know we're going to get to some of your books here soon, I do want to ask, I mentioned it at the very beginning, what is an accidental birder? I do not understand what is happening that you are doing on accident over and over and over and over and over and over and over again.
Well, the birding itself isn't accidental, okay? Though it is a bit compulsive. I mean, I cannot pass it and not look to see what it is, right?
Sure. But
you're referring, my son and I write a blog called fathersonbirding.com. Mm-hmm. And this all started because in 2016, we decided to do a big year of birding, which is see how many species of birds we could see in one calendar year in the U.S. and Canada. And we saw, I think, like 337 species, something.
That's not bad. Yeah.
Okay.
That's a lot.
Especially because, I mean, these serious big year birders are getting like 700-800 species, but they are flying across the country
to
see a single bird, right? You know.
Yes.
But last year it occurred to me by midsummer that I was really close to breaking my big year record. And I had two trips to Texas still coming up and another one to the Oregon coast. And I needed about 80 species, but I thought I could do it. And so I was invited down to Texas to speak at some birding events, actually. And so one of my prerequisites is that someone would have to take me birding when I went down there.
You just write that right into the contract, right?
Exactly, exactly. And I got really a crew of four people from Houston Audubon who just took me everywhere. They were
Nice.
And that is a great organization to support. And no matter where you live, they're an amazing conservation organization. And so I got really close to my big year target. I was within about 10, 15 birds. And then we went out to the Oregon coast for Christmas. And the first day out there, I broke my record. And
Wonderful.
It was so much fun. But this year, my son decided he was going to set a target of 400 species. And he got a summer job looking for northern goshawks in the Sierras of California. So I said, well, if you're doing a big year, let's drive to California through Arizona and bird all the way there. And we blew past 400 on the trip. And I immediately said, okay, you need to set a new target of 500. And he's going, I don't know. I said, no, you do. And so he finally succumbed. And he's at about 475 right now.
Wow. And it's only September.
Yeah, but if you don't have 95% of your birds by July, it's going to be tough slogging.
Okay.
So that's accidental big year birding.
I like it.
That's awesome. Okay, so now tell us about a few of your books and where people can find out more information about all of the books that you've written.
Oh, well, they can go to my website, which is sneedbycollardthethird.com. That's easy to find. And or my blog, there's some information about on the father-son birding site there, too. One book I especially wanted to talk about is Waiting for a Warbler, which also combines what we've been talking about today.
Yeah.
During our big year, I was so amazed by these migrating songbirds that we saw when we visited Texas, that I went to write a book about the migrating songbirds.
Right.
And so I did. But my editor suggested, well, why don't you also write about a family waiting for these songbirds to get back to North America?
Okay.
And I thought, well, that's a great idea. That's right up my alley too, you know.
Nice.
So it's a parallel story of a family trying to improve their backyard habitat. And
this
warbler flying, making this treacherous trip across the Gulf of Mexico, trying to get to its nesting grounds. And of course, he ends up with his mate in the backyard of the family that's been trying to improve their habitat.
That's nice.
Yeah, so it's a really fun story. It's called Waiting for a Warbler. And then I also, at the same time, had another picture book out called Beaver and Otter Get Along, Sort of. And that's,
I love that title.
And that's also kind of a habitat improvement story, except the beavers are doing the habitat improvement. And they, people who study climate science and drought and all kinds of things, think that beavers really have the potential to transform the West, to improve the water situation, improve, you know, carbon capture along these dry old stream beds. Turns out if you put some beavers in a dry valley, chances are you're going to have a running stream within a couple of years.
I've heard about that. They're pretty amazing animals. Engineers. Little
they
engineers.
Engineers. In fact, they might be a good guest for you to have.
There you go. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So with the books, especially Waiting for a Warbler, you mentioned that there's a family that's building the backyard. And we've been talking about backyard habitat this whole time. What is a great way for kids, younger people, regardless of age, to sort of get started in this? Is it tugging on mom and dad's shirt saying, hey, can you take us to the tree and plant buying place? Or is it learning about? What's a good way to get started?
Well, you know, one great way to get started is, first of all, do a little research, right? Mm-hmm. And a great way to do that, I believe I sent you the link. Audubon has an amazing website called www.audubon.org/native-plants. Okay.
Okay.
And no matter where you live, you can get on that site and you put in where you live and then you put in what you'd like to attract. And it will pop up with a list of native plants.
That is a great starting
point. I'm going to do that.
Yeah. And then you print it out. You go to your local nursery. And full disclosure, a lot of nurseries do not carry a lot of native plants. They have some. And so that's why it's good to have a list. And pick out three or four that you would like to have. And I would just start with one or two. But before you go, also pick out the space around your house or in your
right.
Yes.
Where you would like to put it. Be thinking 50 years ahead, right? what could go here? Do I want flowers? Do I have room for a nice bush that's 5 to 10 feet high? Or could I put in a whole tree in this spot? And just go and get your plant and try that. You can also, though, if you know, for instance, if you have native plants nearby that you really like, in the midsummer, you can go collect some seeds from them. From seeds.
Yeah.
And that, like as with my oak example earlier, the plants are often a lot more vigorous if you do it that way than buying them in a pot.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's kind of my challenge to listeners, is just plant one native plant that would be good for wildlife and see where that takes you. It may just change your whole life. You never know. Yeah.
I think that's awesome. So yes, you preempted me with asking what your challenge is. So we will definitely have that link for Audubon on our website. So everybody make sure and look that up. But that's your challenge, to go out and plant just one. I think even I can do that. Hopefully it will survive. I like to pick plants that I don't have to water and can be in full sun, because the way our house is situated, we have full sun in the morning and full sun in the afternoon in the back. So it's like one place or another. That's just, you know, we don't have a lot of trees around here.
Do you want trees around your place?
We actually planted a red oak in front. So we have a red oak and it's getting bigger and bigger. And it's finally, it's been there probably 5 or 6 years. So it's kind of getting bushier and more beautiful. But yeah, I love oaks, and that's what we planted in our old house and that we lived in Jacksonville too. Oaks are just, they're my favorite. So, and I think everybody should do this, but we could talk about this forever. So unfortunately, we need to say goodbye. But thank you so much for being on the show, Sneed. This has
thank
been
you,
so
Sneed.
Much fun. Yes.
Oh, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it. And just enjoy the beautiful fall coming up and plant some plants.
There you go.
I like it.
Thanks for being on Solve It for Kids.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
And see, what did we tell you? This is gonna touch everybody. And I think my favorite part of this episode was everybody lives in a different area. Just like I'm in Colorado, Jen's in Florida. The habitats and the animals and the life that is gonna come to our backyard habitats are different everywhere. So this is a really cool thing to learn about and share with our friends.
Yes, exactly. And I'm so excited to have gotten all these tips because there are all these things that I'd like to do in my backyard, especially when Sneed started talking about, you know, putting out bird feeders and how to, you know, have birds come to your backyard, which might drive my dog crazy, by the way. But I think that's cool. So I hope a lot of you take some of his tips and do his challenge and actually learn
yes.
about the wildlife and the habitats around where you live.
And I'm sure most of us kind of have some ideas. Obviously, we're seeing the birds and the animals
right.
that are around. But really, how much have we been paying attention to what those animals are eating and how often they're around? This just gives us a great opportunity to dive deeper into it.
Right, and learn more about the place where you live, right?
Absolutely.
So if you do all of this, we would love to hear from you. Please contact us through our social media. We are at KidSolve at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And don't forget to check out our website, solveitforkids.com, where we'll have a website page for this very episode. And we'll get Sneed to show us some pictures of some of the backyard habitats that he has changed. So you can see the difference that you can make in the world.
Very cool. Until our next episode, I will be outside protecting my tomato plants from my local deer in our habitat. You'll hear us next time on
Solve It for Kids.